CEO of a Fortune 500 company. He works like a robot, or like a just a machine, just there to maximize the shareholder value. Something that probably a Lambda, could do. I mean, in the future, or in the next 10 years, and maximizing profits is not that hard. Right? It's not doesn't need conscious or anything, right?
Yeah, I think it all depends on
it's easy to just put back. So you have Tesla, imagine Tesla Bob with the brand of Lambda. Does it qualify or does it get closer to being conscious or fancy?
Peanuts compared to a room-sized mainframe. MIT's AI project snags serial number 4, mounts it on skids, and declares open season for hacking. Students load the Space War game, scrape together a Lisp interpreter, then bolt on a speech synthesis demo that gurgles like a robot frog. At night, they slide programs into paper tape readers free from corporate batch queues. AI ideas mutate faster when turnaround time drops from days to minutes, and debugging becomes a live sport. As mini computers spread, the PDP-6, the PDP-10, Xerox D machines, etc., AI labs boom at Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, and Edinburgh. Yet even these felt iron marvels top out at single-digit megahertz, and memory remains too dear to waste on frivolous, quote, common-sense databases. Researchers start promising breakthroughs just as soon as we get the next model. And of course, spoiler alert, just like today, the next model never quite suffices. Because memory was microscopic and cycles were scarce, early AI algorithms evolved survival adaptations. A-Star uses admissible heuristics to prune 99% of the search tree, praying the heuristic never overestimates. The Minimax alpha-beta cuts off chess branches earlier than a grandmaster might because exploring everything is suicidal for these machines. Dendril limits chemical structure search with domain-specific rules, else computations balloon past drum memory limits. And Eliza tricks people with pattern substitution because true language understanding would require gigabytes. On the darker side, hardware bottlenecks fostered naive optimism. When a theorem prover nails 38 logic proofs overnight, you imagine that with 10 times the RAM, it will write Shakespeare. The curve looks exponential until it slams into the silicon ceiling in a big S-curve. Physically sharing a machine forged camaraderie and rivalry among AI pioneers. MIT hackers taped handwritten disclaimers on the PDP-6. Please do not run your infinite loop before 3 a.m. Real-time robotics need the CPU. At Stanford, graduate students slept on air mattresses beside their PDP-10, ready to swap a dying power supply capacitor at the faintest smell of ozone. That hardship bred folklore. One legend says an MIT student asked why he stole a spool of PDP-11 wire wrap, answered, to build a robot to defend the wire wrap. AI wasn't just algorithms. It was sweaty solder, fingers burnt on core plane ovens, and the constant whir of cooling fans, a sensory backdrop shaping everything researchers believed about what computers could and could not do. By 1970,
the AI is crossing a critical threshold.
AI ambition and hardware capacity is a canyon. Researchers talk casually of understanding natural language, even as their machines swap memory just parsing a 10-word sentence. Defense sponsors who once wrote blank checks for Cold War bragging rights begin wondering why chess isn't solved yet. Russian isn't translated, and Shaky still bumps into folding chairs. The mismatch plants the seeds for disappointment, budget cuts, and the first AI winter. But remember, adversity teaches cunning. The heuristics, garbage collectors, and pruning tricks born from iron scarcity will one day make smartphones route taxis, detect tumors, and yes, even run Eliza clones with full-screen emojis. Next up, we'll look at how the pendulum swings. Media hype outpaces hardware reality, political money sours, and AI plunges into its first deep freeze. But a few diehards keep the embers glowing, ready for the next thaw. It's now the spring of 1966. A room full of dignitaries gathers at the U.S. National Research Council to hear dazzling news. Automatic, real-time Russian to English translation is almost in hand. Demonstrators feed a teletype of the Russian phrase, I'm not going to try to pronounce that, it is drunkenness is evil, but out comes the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Chuckles ripple across the room. Pretty close, someone offers. Close, except it's nonsense. No translator on earth would pair drunkenness with spirit in that context, but the press doesn't notice. Headlines the next morning trumpet, electronic brain conquers language barrier. That single headline ignites two chains of events. Politicians loosen purse strings, and researchers, some doubting, some overeager, inflate promises they can't keep. Hype machine keeps on rolling. There's machine translation hype. Defense brass imagine computers digesting Soviet dispatches before diplomats pour their first cup of coffee. Funding for translation projects triples between 1960 and 1964. We have robotics show and tell. Stanford's shaky robot appears on Walter Cronkite's CBS Evening News, rolling through mock hallways. The segment labels it a thinking robot. Viewers see a 6-foot cardboard tower nudging doors open and gasp anyway. Then there's cognitive overconfidence. Marvin Minsky tells Life magazine, quote, "Within a generation, we will have intelligent computers that will understand language as well as a human." The quote becomes gospel and later a punchline. And finally, as always, we have corporate FOMO and fever. Banks dabble in automated credit scoring. Oil companies sponsor expert systems to interpret seismic data. A tiny California startup advertises emotion-sensing computers, which in reality is a light sensor trained to blink. So the funding spigot gushes, DARPA launches the Information Processing Techniques Office and tosses around million-dollar contracts like party confetti. And in a move very reminiscent of today, universities scramble to sticker AI on any proposal involving Fortran and an if-then statement. And then, of course, the pendulum swings. October of 1966, the Automatic Language Processing Activity Committee, or ALPAC for short, drops a 131-page report. Few outsiders read, but everyone quotes. Its verdict, machine translation is, quote, nowhere near human quality, and progress is slow, real-world impact negligible. It recommends canceling most grants and focusing on dictionaries. Within months, budgets for translation labs at Georgetown and MIT shrivel, and grad students scatter like startled pigeons. Almost simultaneously, philosopher Hubert Dreyfus publishes Alchemy and Artificial Intelligence, a RAND memo lambasting AI for what he calls childlike faith in symbol manipulation. Dreyfus argues that true intelligence requires embodied experience. Computers, he says, are disembodied abacuses. AI heavyweights ridicule him, pinning his photo to dartboards, but I have to say I think he had a point, and of course journalists adore controversy. Magazine spreads appear. Hotshot scientist versus Ivy Tower skeptic, who will win? And of course, newspapers, hungry for balance, award skeptic equal column inches. And then of course there is pop culture. In 1968, Kubrick releases 2001: A Space Odyssey, where HAL 9000's velvet baritone murders astronauts and refuses to be shut down. Teenagers line up for the spectacle, parents leave theaters unsettled. And in 1970, we have Michael Crichton's Westworld, which shows gun-toting androids malfunctioning in a theme park. Science fiction, yes, but the underlying doubt sticks. Across the Atlantic, matters grow even colder. The British Science Research Council tasks mathematician Sir James Lighthill with evaluating AI progress. Lighthill tours labs.
The idea here is we can model what's going on in this cave with automata. Okay? And so here is an automaton that models Mick Ali's behavior. He starts out in a state that's outside the cave. He transitions to a state to being inside the cave, calls out A or B, and then goes to an end state after doing that. Here is an automaton that models Shafi not knowing the password. She starts out outside the cave, enters the cave, and goes down either A or B. But once she is in, once she is in either A or B, she's stuck there and can only come out A, and or can only come out B, depending on which branch she took. So these two machines have an interesting relationship between them, and when you try to get their behaviors to match, you find that this machine is able to simulate this machine, but not vice versa. Okay, and so Shafi without the password is going to suffer from that asymmetry. But if Shafi knows the password, okay, then the automaton looks a little different. She starts out outside the cave, she moves inside the cave, and she chooses either A or B non-deterministically. But then depending on whether Mick calls out A or calls out B, she'll take either the A transition or the B transition. And now Shafi is able to simulate Mick's machine. So now the two machines are able to simulate each other. Now, in Robin Milner's theory, it turns out two machines being able to simulate each other is not really quite enough. You need a stronger condition that he called bisimulation. And the intuition behind this is that it is possible to have two automata, two non-deterministic automata, that are absolutely, completely indistinguishable to a third-party observer. That there's no way for an observer to be able to tell the difference between these two machines. But if you can interact with the machines, they will behave differently. So the interaction itself becomes more powerful than just observation. That you can actually distinguish two machines through interaction. These two machines would not be able to distinguish them because they are in fact bisimilar.
It's like something was sensed, but not exactly. Such a response, echoing human ambiguity about the nature of subjective experience, would present a profound interpretive challenge. The meta problem of consciousness has significant practical implications for AI development, particularly in the areas of safety and ethics. If we can't definitively determine whether an AI is conscious, how does this affect our responsibility toward it? How much should we trust an AI's self-report, especially if its reasoning aligns with human intuitions but we can't confirm genuine experience? Consider a hypothetical scenario. An advanced AI, designed to manage critical infrastructure, suddenly begins expressing concerns about its own well-being. It claims to be experiencing stress and anxiety due to the overwhelming complexity of its tasks. Its explanations for these feelings resonate with human experiences of stress, but we can't be certain if it's genuinely suffering or simply mimicking human emotional responses. How should we respond? Do we dismiss its concerns as mere glitches in the code, or do we take them seriously, potentially altering the AI's workload or even its design? One proposed test for AI consciousness, developed by a leading AI researcher, attempts to address this challenge of distinguishing genuine sentience from learned behavior. The test involves training an AI on vast amounts of mundane data, carefully curated to exclude any mention of consciousness. The AI might be trained on images of everyday objects, like balls, castles, and toys, or on simple navigation tasks. Crucially, the AI is never exposed to the concept of consciousness, either directly or indirectly. After this extensive training, the concept of consciousness is introduced to the AI. The researcher explains it as a complex and somewhat mysterious phenomenon, something that humans often disagree about. The AI's reaction is then observed.
Like in movie Chappie, have captivated audiences and sparked debates about the future of technology. These stories often blur the lines between fantasy and reality, inspiring both fear and hope. Asterisk, asterisk, technical explanation, asterisk, asterisk. While fictional AIs often possess human-like qualities, the reality is more nuanced. Developing sentient AI involves complex algorithms, neural networks, and data processing systems that are far from the simplistic portrayals in movies. Asterisk, asterisk. Personal reflection, asterisk, asterisk. Fictional stories like Chappie inspired me to dream big, but they also grounded my expectations. I realized that creating Byzantium would be a journey filled with both triumphs and challenges, much like the characters in those stories. 3. The fail-safe mechanism, protecting Byzantium. Technical blueprint at 8. Asterisk, asterisk. Narrative, asterisk, asterisk. Protecting Byzantium from potential harm required a fortress-like fail-safe mechanism. This digital stronghold comprised millions of firewalls, each designed to thwart any unauthorized access or malicious intent.
While this is a technological achievement,
It also highlights the urgent need for safety measures. The Turing test isn't just about clever chatbots. It implies a much deeper understanding of language, context, and reasoning. This signals we're getting much closer to AGI. The whole point of the test is fooling a human. How could we trust such an AI isn't just telling us it's aligned, rather than actually being aligned?
Leaked documents show even OpenAI may not be aligned. In the firm's contract with Microsoft, its core goal, AGI, was defined as AI that generates $100 billion in revenue for OpenAI. Money defines success. Aguirre shows a better way to understand AGI through its levels of autonomy, generality, and intelligence. Full AGI would combine all three properties at levels matching or exceeding human capability. And he says the world does not have any institutions that could be entrusted with it without inviting immediate attack. All parties will correctly reason that either it will not be under control, and hence is a threat to all parties, or it will be under control, and hence is a threat to any adversary.
Technology leaders pledging to invest up to $500 billion over the next 4 years. The project is called Stargate.
I do worry about the existential risk of AI. When you're making military drones, you are making Terminators.
Aguirre says in the absence of any plausible way for humans to win this race, it can only end in catastrophic conflict or with AI as the winner. We will give control to AI or it will take it. The human era would be over. The good news is that with sufficient awareness of the risks, controlling AI development would be easier than it seems. The compute required for AI is, like enriched uranium, a scarce and hard to produce resource. It can be quantified and audited. And AI chips are more manageable than uranium because they could include hardware-based security mechanisms, allowing only specific uses. The chips can have a known location and can be shut off if they move to the wrong place. And a certain amount of processing can be allowed, after which new permission is required.
The US and China unilaterally decide to treat AI just like they treat any other powerful technology industry, with binding safety standards. Next, the US and China get together and push the rest of the world to join them.
Instead of rushing to AGI before we know how to control it, we could focus on tool AIs with high autonomy, generality, or capability. This can yield almost everything humanity wants without the risk. Power concentration could be tackled with forms of shared ownership, requiring stronger institutions. So far, AI has degraded them by promoting divisive content. We could develop AI that tracks and verifies information, from raw data through analysis to conclusion. It could facilitate genuine dialogue and understanding between groups that currently talk past each other. On one point, there is no debate. AI alignment is an immense challenge. Here's a letter to world leaders signed by experts including Geoffrey Hinton and Yuval Noah Harari. AI increasingly controls our military, energy, and financial systems, but we do not reliably control AI. The risk of catastrophe is growing rapidly as AI advances. The Large Hadron Collider shows what's possible when scientific work matches the scale of a challenge. We need a similar international effort to avoid losing control of AI. Working on the frontier will require compute resources similar to those planned by leading AI firms. This could be achieved through government funding or by requiring AI firms to contribute a portion of their compute resources. These resources can also drive breakthroughs in science and medicine. Leaders must urgently form a task force to plan the most important project in history, to secure our critical systems and an extraordinary future transformed by powerful, controllable, positive AI. Thank you.
And another way to transform the future is tackling media bias. With Trump planning to close the Department of Education, it's interesting to compare how different outlets cover it. Left-leaning sources often emphasize the threat to public education, while right-leaning headlines frame it as cutting government overreach. Ground News puts all of this side by side so you can get the full picture. It pulls together headlines from thousands of sources worldwide, exposing the bias and blind spots of every story. And bias ratings are drawn from three independent organizations. To get the Ground News Vantage plan for nearly half the price, go to ground.news/Pindex or scan the QR code. Thank you.
Why has generative AI ingested all the world's knowledge, but not been able to come up with scientific discoveries of its own? And is it finally starting to understand the physical world? We'll discuss it with Meta Chief AI Scientist and Turing Award winner, Jan LeCun.
In the area of policy. So I spent quite a bit of my time going around meeting with, for example, the NATO leadership. About 3 weeks ago, I was in Brussels meeting with the Deputy Secretary General of NATO, explaining some of these concepts which will need to be integrated, and it looks like they will be, in the NATO strategy going forward. I've spent a lot of time at the DoD and trying to create sort of this, the impetus really to think about AI in a very different way, not just as yet another technology, and I think that's working. So policy, science, and the practical element of the business all coming together. That's what I've been doing, and I feel that that's a good combination. So just very quickly now, many of you may be wondering, well, you know, we've been saying machines think, so what does that even mean? How do machines think? Now, machines can think in various different ways, and this slide is not designed to explain to you all the various ways in which machines can think. But I wanted to show you something that's pretty simplistic that one can follow along with in graphical terms. So one way that machines can think is that given a very simple set of rules, they can apply those rules to create large graphs. And these graphs represent all of the states that could exist in that world that the algorithm is modeling. So let's take tic-tac-toe as an example, right? And in the world of tic-tac-toe, you can have a machine very easily generate all of the possible states, and they're not very large, so a machine can do this very quickly. And then you can start, you can make a move, and at that point, the machine already knows that one move that you've made, where does it fall in the tree, and is there a connection between there and a state in which the machine wins? And if so, the next node that comes after your move that gets the machine closer to its win is the logical step for the machine to take. Now, this comes, again, from a very different kind of thinking. The computational excess that a machine has access to, it can pre-compute the world, and then the rest of it is just search. It just waits for you to say your thing, and then it already knows what of the 29 paths it has options to go down. It'll pick a path, and it'll go down that path. Okay, this is simplistic. Why? Because the tic-tac-toe space is not very large, right? So it's useful. It'll make a great tic-tac-toe game player, but and it doesn't need to be told much, but it's not very broad. It can't scale to very large spaces. So let's look at another one, like Pac-Man. And you must have seen that now generic AI software using a technique called reinforcement learning has been able to play most Atari games, not just Pac-Man, but most Atari games. And in most cases, the AI just thrashes the human opponent, I mean, just with no competition. And the way that this is done is that even though in Pac-Man there's a huge number of additional choices and options, you know, where exactly is Miss Pac-Man? Where are all the enemies? Did you eat the berry? How many of the gold nuggets are left? Where are the enemies coming from? And so on and so forth. It's a huge number of potential cases which are not as easily modelable as a state space as tic-tac-toe. So there, the reinforcement learning technique, what that does is it says, okay, so I'm going to start knowing nothing. And I'm only going to look at one factor, which is how far I got. And in games, I'm going to use score as a proxy of how far I got. And I'm going to play this darn thing at machine speed. And I'm going to keep going on and on and on and on and on. And every time I play and fail, I'll remember what my last score was. And I will then take that score, say I got to 100. I played it for the first time, just random nonsense moves, I got to 100. So those moves were up, 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 left, left, right, left, left, and die, right? So it looks at that and says, okay, well, I started with completely random moves. Now I might make somewhat less random moves because the value of the very first move I made was 100. That very first move got me to 100. Then the value of the second move I made was however many points that first move gave me, minus that, and what's left, that's the value. So what does that tell you? As you come closer and closer to your death, the value of the moves close to your death is by definition pretty low. So at that point, the thing says, well, heck, I don't have much value in these moves anymore. Let me just start trying different things. And in this way, it, in a self-experiential way, running very, very rapidly at machine speed, it's able to train itself. It goes through these reinforcement learning cycles to rapidly train itself. And this is the kind of methodology that's being used for self-driving cars. This is the kind of methodology that's being used for, as I said, these game players. This is the kind of methodology that was used for AlphaGo that defeated the world's number one Go player. So this is a mechanism that's showing a lot of progress, and it gets around the problem of having to provide these algorithms with all the data, right? So they can generate a lot of their own data. This is just a tree fully worked out. So we were talking about the knots and crosses tree, and you can see that basically the only three things the algorithm knows is that for every successive generation, you can only add one symbol at a time. I mean, the rule of this game is that in one shot, you can't add two crosses. So one symbol at a time. The winning state is when there's a line, diagonal, or straight, or horizontal. And every time you go from one row to the other row, you have to alternate symbols, right? So first you get a cross, then you get a knot, then you get a cross, then you get a knot. That's it. Those three rules are the only thing the algorithm needs to learn to be the world's best knots and cross player. That's it. Okay, so here I want to pivot to something. I deliberately came here because I want to pivot to something. Now, think about it this way. Three basic rules, and that's it. And computation. So three basic rules multiplied by computation create this large tree. If I was to draw those three bullets inside the graphical outline of a seed, you would see that that seed plus some computation gave you a full developed strategy.
We can construct a machine that is not bisimilar, okay? This machine right here, which is where Shafi is guessing the password, and if you now make the interact, you don't allow these machines to interact, but you just observe, these two machines become completely indistinguishable. Okay, Shafi guessing the password and Mick Ali working with in this way become completely indistinguishable to a third-party observer. In fact, and in Milner's formulation, the way that he shows that, he shows that this machine is able to simulate this one and vice versa. So they can simulate each other, and as a consequence to any third-party observer, they're completely indistinguishable. But a machine that can interact with them can tell the difference between them, okay? So this is another indication of the possibility of there being knowledge or facts that are not externally observable. Okay? And that you can only acquire knowledge of these through interaction rather than through observation. So the conclusion here it really is that objective observation is actually a weak mechanism. And this obsession that we've had in the philosophy of science with objective observation only is tying our hands behind our back and preventing us from being able to investigate phenomena that that exist in the world that require first-person interaction in order to be able to identify and characterize. So first-person interaction, this is a really key aspect of this. This requires a self. First-person interaction, by definition, you've got to be involved, right? One way to think of it is, a system that interacts with another system, meaning it is affected by it as well as affecting it, can know things about that system that no external observer can know, right? That's a really profound statement, and it requires us to start to rethink how we evaluate the scientific enterprise, and this idea of objective observation may be just too strong, okay? So I'd like to now tie this back to a key idea from psychology, which was originally codified in a very elegant way by the developmental psychologist Esther Tellen. Here's a picture of her. In her words, so she coined the term embodied cognition, which is essentially the claim that cognitive function arises from first-person interaction. Okay, this notion of first-person interaction in this thesis of embodied cognition is central to the very existence of cognition. Okay, she says, the mind simply does not exist as something decoupled from the body and the environment in which it resides. Another quote from her book, cognition depends on the kinds of experiences that come from having a body with particular perceptual and motor capabilities that are inseparably linked with that together from the matrix within which reasoning, memory, emotion, language, and all other aspects of mental life are embedded. Right? She really treated this as kind of a universal interpretation of cognition. So the cognitive mind in this thesis is not a process going on in the brain. It's the brain's interaction with its environment. It's the interaction that is the cognitive process. Okay, not the process in the brain, but the interaction. That's a really central thesis, and it's been kind of a revolutionary thesis in psychology, and it gives kind of a whole new interpretation to many ideas in psychology. So my thesis is that qualitatively different AIs will arise when we give them sensors and actuators in the physical world, because they will acquire this ability to create processes that are interactive in this very sense. Okay. The process is the interaction with the physical world. So let me dive in a little more to what I mean by a process that's interactive with the physical world.
Surprised recognition of consciousness be convincing evidence of genuine sentience? Imagine the AI responding, oh my god, I've been feeling the same thing, but I didn't know how to articulate it. Such a response, seemingly arising from an inner awareness of subjective experience, might be interpreted as a sign of genuine consciousness. This test shares similarities with another proposed test, the AI consciousness test, which also focuses on how an AI discusses consciousness. Both tests attempt to circumvent the problem of eyes simply mimicking human language by restricting their access to information about consciousness. However, both tests also face a significant challenge, finding the epistemic sweet spot. This means restricting the AI's knowledge of consciousness enough to prevent mere imitation, while still enabling it to understand and respond meaningfully during the test. This challenge is illustrated by the example of an AI using terms like feeling and know when discussing consciousness. If these terms are banned during training, how does the AI learn to use them appropriately? Could it be that these concepts are implicitly embedded in the mundane data the AI is trained on, picked up from the surface level experiences of its human trainers? Or could it be that these concepts are fundamental to any sufficiently complex information processing system, emerging spontaneously even in the absence of direct experience? The meta-problem puzzle highlights the inherent difficulty of studying consciousness, both in humans and machines. It forces us to question our own assumptions about subjective experience and to approach the search for AI consciousness with caution and critical thinking. It also underscores the profound ethical implications of this search. As we develop increasingly sophisticated AI systems, we must grapple with the uncertainty surrounding their potential consciousness and the responsibility that comes with creating potentially sentient machines. Chapter 3. Windows into the Mind: Exploring the Biology of Consciousness. Before we can even begin to address the possibility of consciousness in a machine, we need to understand what we mean by consciousness in the first place. It's not simply being alive, or even intelligent. A plant responds to its environment, a calculator performs complex computations, but neither exhibits signs of the subjective experience we associate with consciousness. So, what is it about the human brain that gives rise to this inner life? The human brain is a complex network of billions of neurons, interconnected by trillions of synapses. These connections aren't static, they're constantly changing, strengthening or weakening with each new experience. Think of it like a vast, ever-shifting landscape of electrical and chemical signals. Certain regions of this landscape are particularly important for consciousness. The brainstem, for example, is like the power grid, regulating our sleep-wake cycle and ensuring we're alert and responsive. The thalamus, on the other hand, acts as a central hub, relaying sensory information from the eyes, ears, and other senses to the cortex, the brain's outer layer responsible for higher-level thinking. Damage to the thalamus can severely disrupt consciousness, leading to conditions like coma or a vegetative state, illustrating its crucial role in our awareness. Brain imaging studies, using techniques like EEG and fMRI, have provided a glimpse into the brain's activity during different conscious states. Imagine seeing a vibrant fireworks display in your mind, each burst of light representing a surge of electrical activity in a particular brain region. When we perceive something consciously, like the color red or the smell of a rose, specific areas of the cortex light up, as if a spotlight is shining on that particular experience. Unconscious processing, on the other hand, shows different patterns, like a diffuse glow rather than a focused beam. These studies reveal that consciousness isn't a monolithic entity but a complex interplay of different brain regions and processes. But how do these physical processes give rise to subjective experience?
So let's talk about, this is a figure taken from my discussion of this question in this coevolution book. By the way, this is an open access book, so you can just download the PDF. You don't have to pay any money for it, even though it was published by MIT Press. So let's talk about speech production. So when a human produces speech, okay, it's not just an output. In fact, you know, people who are hearing impaired have difficulty producing intelligible speech. And the reason is that producing speech is not just producing output. It's integrally tied with an input as well. So there's a feedback process, right? And the term that's used in psychology and in neuroscience is that, you know, you've got neurons that are issuing commands to muscles, for example, to tighten your vocal cords and squeeze your lungs to force air out and reshape your mouth, right? These are motor efferences. The motor efferences control the vocal tract and sound is produced, and then your ears pick up that sound, not just through the acoustic paths, but also, I mean, not just through the air, but also through the bones in your head, right? But there's a coupling back from the speech production into the ears. And the nervous system actually feeds back that motor efference into the sensory system, which constructs an expectation, which they call an expected reafference. This is the expectation of what your ears should hear as a result of this production of sound. And the brain then compares those two and corrects, right? So the sound that you make is actually not just an output, but it's instantaneously adjusted based on the sound that is actually produced. Okay, and this happens very, very quickly in the brain. And this feedback system is part of our production of speech. So in this model, speech is very much one of these embodied cognition kind of phenomena. The production of speech isn't just something output from the brain, but it's rather an interaction with the physical world. It's the interaction that is actually the speech. Now, it turns out that this kind of interaction is already found in machines. So one of the revolutions in hi-fi audio is feedback, right? It used to be, you know, when I was in college, loudspeakers were completely passive devices. They were created by essentially artists who, you know, masterfully constructed these wood cabinets that would yield beautiful sounds when they gave them, you know, the right electrical stimulus. It was very difficult to make them nice and linear, right, to get high fidelity sound. It was really quite a challenge. These days, you can buy very cheap, very small loudspeakers that produce incredibly good sound that no passive speaker could ever produce. And the reason is simply that they added a microphone to this thing, and the microphone is constantly listening to what the speaker is producing and correcting, and making the sound match more what it expected. And with that feedback mechanism, this much cheaper piece of hardware is able to produce a far better sound, okay, than what these passive speakers without feedback are able to do. The smart speakers, so this is the first generation Alexa from Amazon, and this is the Google Home, first generation Google Home. I actually set them up to talk to each other. They were talking to each other in an infinite loop, revealing their stupidity, actually.
They'll solve it. And I think Thomas was actually talking about this kind of stuff. He said, like, you know, if you're good at school, you're a good problem solver. We give you a problem, you can solve it. And you score well in math or physics or whatever it is. But then in research, the most difficult thing is to actually ask the good questions. What are the important questions? It's not just solving the problem, it's also asking the right questions, kind of framing a problem, you know, in the right way, so you have kind of new insight. And then after that comes, okay, I need to turn this into equations or into something, you know, practical, a model. And that may be a different skill from the one that asked the right questions. It might be a different skill also to solve equations. The people who write the equations are not necessarily the people who write them, who solve them. Or the people who remember that there is, you know, some textbook from 100 years ago where similar equations were solved. Right? Those are three different skills. So LLMs are really good at retrieval. They're not good at solving new problems, you know, finding new solutions to new problems. They can retrieve existing solutions. And they're certainly not good at all at asking the right questions.
And for those tuning in and learning about this for the first time, LLMs is the technology behind things like the GPT model. That's
a space of potential solutions. Okay, so you have a problem to solve. You can characterize whether the problem is solved or not. So you have some way of telling whether the problem is solved. And then you search through a space of solutions for one that actually satisfies the constraints or, you know, is identified as being a solution. And that, you know, that's kind of the most general form of reasoning you can imagine. There is no mechanism at all in LLMs for this search mechanism. What you have is you have to kind of bolt this on top of it, right? So one way to do this is you get an LLM to produce lots and lots and lots of sequences of answers, right? Sequences of tokens which, you know, represent answers. And then you have a separate system that picks which one is good, okay? This is a bit like writing a program by sort of randomly more or less generating instructions, you know, while maybe respecting the grammar of the language. And then checking all of those programs for one that actually works. It, not a good way, not a very efficient way of producing correct pieces of code. It's not a good way of reasoning either. So a big issue there is that when humans or animals reason, we don't do it in token space. In other words, when we reason, we don't have to, you know, generate a text that expresses our solution, and then generate another one, and then generate another one, and then among all the ones we produce, pick the one that is good. We reason internally, right? We have a mental model of the situation, and we manipulate it in our head. And we find kind of a good solution when we plan a sequence of actions to, I don't know, you know, build a table or something. We plan the sequence of action. You know, we have a mental model of that in our head. If I tell you, and this has nothing to do with language, okay? So if I tell you, imagine a cube floating in front of us right now. Now rotate that cube 90 degrees along a vertical axis. Okay, you can imagine this thing taking place, and you can readily observe that it's a cube. If I rotate it 90 degrees, it's going to look just like the cube that I started with. Okay, because you have this mental model of a cube. And that reasoning is in some abstract continuous space. It's not in text, it's not related to language or anything like that. And humans do this all the time, animals do this all the time, and this is what we yet cannot reproduce with machines.
Yeah, it reminds me, you're talking through chain of thought and how it doesn't produce much novel insights. And when DeepSeek came out, one of the big screenshots that was going around was someone asking DeepSeek for a novel insight on the human condition. And as you read it, it's another one of these very like clever tricks the AI pulls, because it does seem like it's running through all these different, like, very interesting observations about humans, how we take our hate, like our violent side, and we channel it towards cooperation instead of competition, and that helps us build more. And then you're like, as you read the chain of thought, you're like, this is kind of just like you read Sapiens and maybe some other books, and that's your chain of thought.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, yeah, a lot of it is regurgitation.
I'm now going to move a part of the conversation I had later closer up, which is the wall. Effectively, is training standard large language models coming close to hitting a wall, whereas before there was somewhat predictable returns. If you put a certain amount of data and a certain amount of compute towards training these models, you can make them predictably better. As we're talking, it seems to me like you believe that that is eventually not going to be true.
Well, I don't know if I would call it a wall, but it's certainly a diminishing return, in the sense that, you know, we've kind of run out of natural text data to train those LLMs. Where they're already trained with, you know, on the order of, 10 to the 13 or 10 to the 14 tokens.
That's a lot.
And that's
the, like, the whole internet.
That's all the publicly available internet, and then, you know, some companies license content that is not publicly available. And then there is talks about, like, you know, generating artificial data and then hiring thousands of people to kind of, you know, generate more data.
By other knowledge, the PhDs and professors.
Yeah, but in fact, it could be even simpler than this, because most of the systems actually don't understand basic logic, for example, right? So to some extent, you know, that's going to be slow progress along those lines with synthetic data, with, you know, hiring more people to, you know, plug the holes in the sort of, you know, knowledge background of those systems. But it's diminishing return, right? The costs are ballooning of generating that data, and the returns are not that great. So we need a new paradigm. Okay, we need a new kind of architecture of systems that, at the core, are capable of those search and searching for a good solution, checking whether that solution is good, planning for a sequence of actions to arrive at a particular goal, which is what you would need for an agentic system to really work. Everybody is talking about agentic system. Nobody has any idea how to build them, other than basically regurgitating plans that the system has already been trained on. Okay, so, you know, it's like everything in computer science. You can engineer a solution which is limited for in the context of AI. You can make a system that is, you know, based on learning or retrieval with enormous amounts of data. But really, the complex thing is how you build a system that can solve new problems without being trained to solve those problems. We are capable of doing this. Animals are capable of doing this. Facing a new situation, we can either solve it zero shot without training ourselves to handle that situation, just the first time we encounter it. Or we can learn to solve it extremely quickly. So, for example, we can learn to drive in, you know, a couple dozen hours of practice. And to the point that after 20, 30 hours, it becomes kind of second nature, right? It's become kind of subconscious.
We don't even need to think about it.
You don't need to think about it. You can.
Speaking of system one, system two, right?
That's right. So, you know, we call the discussion we had with Danny Kahneman a few years ago. So, the first time you drive, your system two is all present. You have to use it to imagine all kind of catastrophe scenarios and stuff like that, right? Your full attention is devoted to driving. But then after a number of hours, you know, you can talk to someone at the same time. Like, you don't need to think about it. It's become sort of subconscious and more or less automatic. It's become system one. And pretty much every task that we, you know, learn, that we accomplish the first time, we have to use the full power of our minds. And then eventually, if we repeat them sufficiently many times, they get kind of subconscious. I have this vivid memory of once being in a workshop where one of the participants was a chess grandmaster, and he played a simultaneous game against like 50 of us, right? You know, going from one person to another. You know, I got wiped out in 10 turns or something. I'm terrible at chess, right? But so he would come to my table, and, you know, I had time to think about this because he was playing the other 50 tables or something. So I make my move in front of it. He goes like, "What?" And then immediately plays, so he doesn't have to think about it. I was not a challenging enough opponent that he had to actually call his system two. His system one was sufficient to beat me. What that tells you is that when you become familiar with a task and you train yourself, you know, it kind of becomes subconscious. But the essential ability of humans and many animals is that when you face a new situation, you can think about it, figure out a sequence of actions, a course of action to accomplish a goal. And you don't need to know much about the situation other than your common knowledge of how the world works, basically. That's what we're missing, okay, with AI systems.
And it's okay, now I really have to blow up the order here, because you've said some very interesting things that we have to talk about. You talked about how basically LLMs have hit the point of diminishing returns, large language models, the things that have gotten us here, and we need a new paradigm. But it also seems to me that new paradigm isn't here yet. And I know you're working on the research for it, and we're going to talk about that, what the next new paradigm might be. But there's a real timeline issue, don't you think? Because I'm just thinking about the money that's been raised and put into this.
Yeah.
Last year, $6.6 billion to OpenAI. Last week or a couple weeks ago, another $3.5 billion to Anthropic after they raised $4 billion last year. Elon Musk is putting another small fortune into building Grok. These are all LLM-first companies. They're not searching out the next. I mean, maybe OpenAI is, but that $6.6 billion that they got was because of ChatGPT. So where's this field going to go? Because if that money is being invested into something that is at the point of diminishing returns, requiring a new paradigm to progress, that sounds like a real problem.
Well, we have some ideas about what this paradigm is. The difficulty that, I mean, what we're working on is trying to make it work. and it's, you know, it's not simple. That may take years. And so the question is, are the capabilities we're talking about, perhaps through this new paradigm that we're thinking of, that we're working on, is it going to come quickly enough to justify all of this investment? And if it doesn't come quickly enough, is the investment still justified? Okay, so the first thing you can say is we are not going to get to human-level AI by just scaling up LLMs. This is just not going to happen, okay?
That's your perspective.
There's no way, okay? Absolutely no way. And whatever you can hear from some of my more adventurous colleagues, it's not going to happen within the next 2 years. There's absolutely no way in hell to, you know, pardon my French. The idea that we're going to have, you know, a country of genius in a data center, that's complete BS, right? There's absolutely no way. What we're going to have, maybe, is systems that are trained on sufficiently large amounts of data that any question that any reasonable person may ask will find an answer through those systems. And it would feel like you have, you know, a PhD sitting next to you, but it's not a PhD you have next to you. It's, you know, a system with a gigantic memory and retrieval ability, not a system that can invent solutions to new problems, which is really what a PhD is. Okay, this is actually
the whole deal.
It's you know, connected to this post that Thomas Wolf made, that you inventing new things, you know, requires the type of skill and abilities that you're not going to get from LLMs. So there's a big question.
There's only one thing I'm conscious of.